This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. This past Friday, April 10th, humanity made history again. And for the first time in over half a century, astronauts traveled to the moon and back as NASA's Artemis II crew splashed down safely off the coast of San Diego, concluding a breathtaking 10-day mission that took them farther from the Earth than any humans have ever traveled.
Joining us this morning is Lee Billings. He's a senior editor at Scientific American, who covers space and physical sciences. With Artemis II now completing its historic journey around the moon, Lee will help us unpack the mission's most fascinating moments, from breathtaking views of the lunar far side to what this milestone means for the future of human space exploration. Lee Billings, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn, Scott, it is great to be here, and I'm so happy that we have good things to talk about instead of bad things for one.
Yeah, you know, it was such a success, and you know, we were talking before we went on air about how you described it almost as a bender, where you've been in your home office for, you know, the entirety of the Artemis II mission, doing the work you do, but also just being absolutely obsessed with it. What was that like for you?
It was exhausting, but it was enthralling seeing humans, as you said, go farther than we've ever gone before, go back to the moon for the first time in a half century, and not just anybody. You know, these four astronauts, Reid Wiseman, mission commander, pilot Victor Glover, mission specialist Christine Cook, and Jeremy Hansen, you couldn't ask for a better crew, a better group. Their dynamics, their heart, their soul, and their courage was just an inspiration, I think, for me, and really, I hope, for everyone who watched. You have to remember that this was a test flight. This was a shakedown flight of NASA's hardware that they're using to try to go to the moon, the Space Launch System mega rocket, the Orion crew capsule, and no one had flown this stuff before. No humans had been on this stuff, and there was significant risk, and they nailed it. It was a nearly flawless mission. We can get into some of the things that didn't go right, but really almost everything went well. And I really do think that, you know, America and the world, we kind of needed this win this year, I think.
Oh, we so needed it. Well, I wanted to bring this up later, but I'll go ahead and bring it up now because I always love to tie Utah into wonderful things that happen in the world. And you know that a portion of the rocket launcher, the booster, was made here in Utah at Northrop Grumman. And the lead into this question is kind of about, you know, past concerns and safety, lessons learned from both Challenger and Columbia missions that ended tragically. And I know that every time I heard with Artemis II mission that there were concerns about reentry with the heat shield, I think for at least people who were around during those missions, it kind of took them back to a scary point. But did you have a lot of confidence that that heat shield, even though there were problems during Artemis I, would be fine?
I was terrified. I was utterly terrified to the degree that I have two small children. And when we watched the reentry, we did ultimately watch the reentry happening live, but I did have misgivings. I said to myself, you know, what are the chances something terrible happens? And do I want to scar my children the way that I was scarred in kindergarten watching Challenger blow up because our teacher had the TV on because we were all watching, Chris McAuliffe, the teacher going to space. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in college when the Columbia disaster happened and the astronauts of that mission lost their lives upon reentry. So I was terrified. And you know, we had kind of this dynamic of dueling experts, with some saying, well, we have plenty of data, there's plenty of margin, we're very confident that by tweaking the Artemis II trajectory through the atmosphere, we'll minimize the exposure of the heat shield to extreme conditions. And of course, again, the reason why this matters, just for people, you know, to unpack this a bit, is that when you come in from space at hypersonic velocity, when you hit the top of the Earth's atmosphere at circa, you know, 25,000 miles per hour, you push all the air in front of you in a shockwave. It heats up with friction. It gets extremely hot. You become engulfed in a fireball, and the temperatures of that fireball are hot enough to melt steel. So you have to find a way to block and dissipate that energy. The Artemis II heat shield uses something called Avcoat, which is what actually was also used in the Apollo era for those moon missions. And it essentially chars and melts and burns away to carry away excess heat to keep the crew safe inside the capsule. And there on Artemis 1, the big chunks of this AVCO material had ripped off and cracked open during the reentry. And people were uncertain whether the Artemis 2 heat shield, which uses the exact same formulation with the same design, would have similar problems. And we came through it okay. They are still analyzing the heat shield now. NASA actually, even one reason that they kept, if you watched on TV and you saw that capsule bobbing around the ocean for a long time, one reason why that took so long is because they actually had divers deployed underneath it to take pictures of it before it was even retrieved to see what the damage looks like. And so now they're going through a very rigorous process of figuring out just how well it performed. But regardless, Artemis 3, which is and other future Artemis missions, are going to use a slightly different heat shield that has been reformulated and hopefully will perform better. But it was very scary.
I agree. I was just glued to the TV set watching Artemis 2 re-enter the atmosphere and thinking, wow, that I can't even imagine what it was like for the astronauts inside the capsule, looking outside that little window, watching the flames go by. It must have been exhilarating and terrifying, I'm sure, at the same time as they were coming back in on reentry. The question I have, I got so many questions, Lee. I'm sorry. We only have 25 minutes for this interview.
Me too.
But I noticed that the command module was attached to, the support module on the way up. And are the astronauts then just confined to the command module for that entire 10-day trip? There's no way for them, I guess, to get into the support module, which I think is what providing life support and propulsion for the command module. Are there plans in the future Artemis missions for them to be able to exit the capsule and maybe into a crew quarter or something?
Well, some of that is actually going to be vital, because the way it is now is that you're right. There is the crew module of Orion, the spacecraft, and there's also the service module. And the service module is mostly built by actually European contractors. And I actually don't know much about how much you can access that from inside the crew module. I would imagine there is a way to get at some of that hardware just in the event of various contingencies. But in future missions, it will be very crucial, actually, for the crew to somehow be able to egress from their Orion crew module into something else. And that's because the official plan of record is that we're going to dock the crew module, the Orion crew capsule, in Earth orbit with something else that will take us to the lunar surface eventually, into the moon. And so Artemis 3, that mission, which is slated for next year, is actually not even going to the moon. It's going to be staying in low Earth orbit. And what it's going to be testing is how that process works, how the crew is able to meet up with another spacecraft, rendezvous and dock with it, and then do the necessary procedures to get checked out and go on to the moon. And right now, the two main contenders for that are SpaceX, Elon Musk's SpaceX, and then Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin. They are both working on human lander system concepts for these future Artemis missions, with the first crewed lunar landing supposed to take place with Artemis 4 in 2028. So it's a very ambitious timescale, and they're going to have to figure out a lot of things in Earth orbit before they actually get anyone to the moon.
Now you've got me really excited. It's very, by the way, this is a morning show, so if anybody is having their coffee or eating breakfast, you may want to pause for this next question, because of course, all we heard about on this mission was how perfect it was, except for the toilet malfunction. And I don't know anything about it. So I'm going to ask you, Lee, what was the deal with the restroom on Artemis?
Yes. So the it's called the Universal Waste Management System. They have to have a fancy acronym for this, right? And it's essentially a 3D printed titanium toilet. That is a marvel of aerospace engineering. It's the first one that's ever been around the moon. The Apollo astronauts actually had to poop and pee in bags, which wasn't, that they had to like stick to their bottoms. It was just a really gross, super gross experience. I'm sorry if you're eating, your breakfast right now, talking about this, listening to this. So it was actually a meaningful advance in that, well, if you're going to go for long duration missions around the moon, or, you're going down there to stay on the lunar surface, you need to have a good way to do your business besides doing it in bags. And the some of the key innovations of this were that it actually has both male and female attachments. So either sex, either gender can use these things very easily in space. You're able to poop and pee simultaneously, which is a big deal. You know, I think that's something that we all know. One kind of follows the other. You couldn't do that before in the Apollo era, right? And so it also has a door, which is really nice. You know, you mentioned how they're all stuck in this crew module. Well, that's about the size of like a large camper van. So there's four people in there. You know, you do the math, and it's a pretty intimate situation. So it has a door, which is nice. But what went wrong with it? They're still analyzing. The issue seems to have been that it was kind of getting clogged, basically, more or less. There is a dump they can use for wastewater, for pee. And the vent for that, dumping it into space, wasn't working properly. They weren't seeing the flows, the throughput that they expected. And they thought maybe it was some kind of ice, some kind of freezing that was gunking up the line. And then so they rotated the craft to sit in sunlight for a while on that vent, didn't really fix the throughput issue. And so they said, okay, it must be something else. The leading theory last I heard was that they think it might have something to do with a chemical reaction between compounds that are in this mix, in this kind of slurry, that are meant to prevent biofilm accumulation, meant to prevent bacterial growth in there. And so for a period of the mission, they did actually have to kind of go back to the old faithful, not peeing in bags, but actually using these kind of specialized, expandable, collapsible plastic containers. And, you know, not the most pleasant thing in the world, but again, it sounds goofy, but it is actually really important for comfort. If we're gonna go on these long-term missions, then people need to be as comfortable as they can be, I think. So, you know, sure, we can send people around the moon. We're still working on the moon toilet, but hey, science marches on, right?
Well, that was a great and lengthy explanation.
And Lynn, I don't think I will ever complain about an airplane toilet ever again.
That's right. That's right. Okay, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Lee Billings. He's the senior editor of space at Scientific American and a space fanatic and an Artemis II fanatic. Okay, just to clarify here, it was funny how interchangeably they used the words Artemis II, Orion, which is the spacecraft, and then what the astronauts called the spacecraft, Integrity, right?
That's right.
Orion is the type of spacecraft that suggests that it's an orbiter, it's not a lander. Is that right?
That's correct. It's actually not going to be able to take anyone to lunar surface on its own. And it is, you know, it does have good life support and so on and so forth. So yeah, Orion is the crew spacecraft that takes them, that keeps them alive in Earth orbit and will keep them alive and doing important things around the moon, but it can't actually take them down to the surface. And then the Space Launch System rocket is the thing that's used to lift Orion up into low Earth orbit. And, you know, future missions may use other solutions. We'll have to see. The Space Launch System is a beautiful big rocket. It's also extremely expensive. When you look at all the costs involved, I think between like Artemis 1 and then up to Artemis 4, we're looking at around $4 billion for the SLS and the Orion, I believe, together per launch.
Yeah.
So we need to find something that probably is a little more sustainable, a little less budget busting to make this program have any longevity and actually do things like NASA wants to do, like build a moon base.
Right, right. So in the future, an orbiter, a craft like Orion, would be the sort of orbiting base that would feed then to a lander on the moon where they could start building, which leads me into the question about the future. I mean, now that Artemis is done, we still have plenty of questions about that. But, you know, looking at the NASA administrator, Jared Isaacson, I mean, that guy he's really pushing for the future of development on the moon. And I think that was the biggest question I got for people is why? What are we going to do on the moon?
That's a great question. And you know, I think it's important to note that there's no single answer, I think, that satisfies everyone in that case. There's a lot of different reasons to go back to the moon. There's a lot of reasons not to go to the moon that some people want to pursue. And rather than go through that whole litany, the reason that NASA wants to go back, I think, is somewhat complicated, but it comes down to There's elements of soft power and geopolitical competition here, in that China also wants to go to the moon. They also want to land people on the moon by 2030. They also have a partnership with Russia, with the Russian space agency Roscosmos and various other nations to build their own independent moon base. We're trying to go to the same place, which is the lunar South Pole, which is where there's things like water ice that you can use to make potable water for drinking, or you can use it to make rocket fuel, or you can dig and get core samples and study it to get a very, very thorough record of how that water got there and how it changed over time on the moon, which can tell you a lot about solar system history and lunar history. So there's lots of different reasons to go to that area. And it's almost like a little bit of a real estate battle that's going on, when who's going to be able to get to the best choicest craters and so on in an X amount of time. And there's lots of reasons, again, to do that, for science, for industry, for the expansion of Earth's economic sphere into cislunar space, all these grand ideas. You know, fundamentally, there is always the question of why should we go back? Why should we go there at all when we have so many problems right here on Earth, right? That's a very valid question. I don't want to dismiss that. I do think that it can be a little unfair to maybe scapegoat this thing, this exploration program, when there are many other aspects of the federal budget that actually are, I would say, much more problematic and much larger in magnitude. You know, NASA went to the moon for, was it something like two pennies of taxpayer funding back in the Apollo era? You know, for every dollar of federal funding that existed, I think two pennies were spent on the Apollo program. I may be a little off of that. You can check my math. Well, right now, NASA's doing everything for less than one penny per dollar. And again, you know, we have lots of other priorities. I'm not saying we should spend half of every dollar on NASA or on the moon program, but it's a relatively small amount of this big thing we call the federal budget. And I like to think that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, basically. And the reason why is because there are other reasons why. There's the inspiration aspect, which is not to be dismissed, I don't think. My two boys certainly loved seeing them go around the moon with Artemis II, and they all of a sudden were talking about how they maybe wanted to be astronauts someday too. And then they better do their push-ups and, you know, eat their vegetables and say their prayers and study up in school. You know, there's kind of a magnifying effect that can occur on these things, where you don't always see immediate tangible returns, but they can cascade and grow in all kinds of unexpected ways. So lots of different reasons to go. I don't know which one's the best. I'm most appealing, you know, myself with the scientific stuff, I think, where the moon is a record of the solar system that's very unique, that we can't really get in many other places, because there's no wind and water there. There's no plate tectonics and volcanism to erase this history that otherwise is erased on Earth and other planets. So you can go there, you can find out some of the deepest questions about our origins, the origins of our planet, maybe the origins of life itself. And you can also do other things, even look at cosmic origins. You can build what many people are very excited about building: radio telescopes on the far side of the moon, where you can't hear the Earth. You can't hear all the radio chatter from Earth, and you can instead just bask in these radio waves from very, very early in the universe, right after the Big Bang, way before stars and galaxies formed and lit up, and it was the Dark Ages. And you can't see anything in the Dark Ages. You don't know how those galaxies and stars came together. And by looking at these radio waves on the far side of the moon from the very beginning of time, you might be able to do that.
I am excited about all of that. And I have a little bit of a different perspective. People, of course, ask me, well, why are you so excited about this, Scott? What's the deal? I mean, you've been staying up for 10 days watching this mission. And I think for me, Lee, and I'd love to get your perspective on this, it's actually just comes down to exploration. I tell people this is very similar to when we thought the Earth was flat and Magellan kind of went off sailing around the world. And my God, we found out the world was actually round. Or when the Wright brothers went bouncing down Kitty Hawk. I mean, they didn't get very far, but now we can take jets anywhere and everywhere around the world. For me personally, I look at this as a stepping stone. Who knows? First, it's the moon. Maybe it's Mars. And in 2, 3, 4 centuries, we're now exploring other solar systems, maybe even other galaxies. What's your perspective on the exploration aspect of all of this?
I think that that's a great question. And I resonate with you on a lot of those feelings. I think that being curious and wondering what's over the next horizon is innate to the human condition, to the human experience. And it sounds so grandiose that is so easy to dismiss as just cheese, as just someone who just doesn't know what they're talking about and they've read too much science fiction. But, you know, this is real life. Like, it's not science fiction. It's the great story of how humans came to, for lack of a better term, dominate planet Earth and ascend to where we are today as a global civilization. Our distant ancestors decided, what's over that hill? What's over that ridgeline? Is it better over there than here? Let's keep going. Let's keep moving. Are there islands that we can't see over the horizon that we can go reach? This is something that we've been doing literally for hundreds of thousands of years, and it's shaped us. It's changed us, you know, in terms of how evolution works and natural selection. I think that it's important to have frontiers. It's important to have some place you can look to and kind of a stretch goal, so to speak. And you can't really think of a better place for that than the moon because it's so close. I mean, Mars has an atmosphere. Mars is much more Earth-like, even though it's still not a great place to live, but it's also a lot farther away. So I think the moon is a stepping stone, I think, as you said.
Well, let's bring it back to the stepping stone for a moment. The astronauts were reporting back to Earth as they rounded the dark side of the moon some of the most spectacular images that they saw. And they almost described it in a poetry fashion. Lee, what were they seeing? What was so awe-inspiring about what they were gazing upon for the first time?
To some degree, you know, we go to the moon to rediscover Earth. And that was a message we learned from the Apollo era. You know, when the crew of Apollo 8 first went to orbit back in 1968 around the moon, things were hard on Earth. And there was a moment of coming together when they were in lunar orbit and it was Christmas Eve. And, you know, they beamed back home goodwill from the Earth. And these images, not just of the barren lunar waste below them, but also of our beautiful blue-green lifeboat floating in the depths of space, far away. And something that comes through for everyone who has gone to the moon, every crew, and especially with Artemis II now, is this sense of awe and wonder and majesty as they look at the desolation of the moon, the craters. You know, it's just craters on craters on craters. And then, you know, they come around the lunar far side, and what is rising up to meet them in space is that view of Earth. And so the things that they saw on the moon were cool and important. If you're a lunar scientist, being able to count craters or see micrometeoroid impacts on the far side, or seeing things like a total solar eclipse, the moon passing over the sun, and all of a sudden you see the moon's dark side lit by Earthshine, by the reflected light of Earth. There's all kinds of cool things you can see out there. But really, again and again, we go to the moon, and what do we find? We find the Earth.
Well, sadly, before we let you go, I wanted to mention that after Orion Integrity landed, I think maybe the splashdown and seeing that whole thing, if you weren't into it in the beginning, seeing the splashdown captured your heart, definitely. And the next morning, I went on to NASA.gov, as I often do, just to read what's going on. They have a wonderful documentary series about all kinds of things. Plus.nasa.gov, I believe. But anyway, you can go on NASA.gov. And of course, you'll be writing about this in the Scientific American. So what can we look forward to?
Well, you know, one of the things that they made the crew do right after they got them out of the capsule and got them onto the flight deck of USS John P. Murtha, and then, you know, airlifted them someplace, was they actually had them run an obstacle course, apparently, where they had to kind of like, they've been in space for 10 days. They just went through this terrible reentry where they all came out okay, but they still pulled, you know, 4 Gs, you know, having like several buddies sit on your chest while you're trying to breathe. And you know, they're probably a little discombobulated. And then they're having to go almost immediately after being recovered from splashdown to go run this obstacle course for the eggheads, right? To figure out, well, how well do you really adapt to that transition? And, you know, what can we expect for future crews? I think what we can expect, if we're looking a little more broadly, is hopefully a sustained push. Hopefully we will keep the momentum going because, you know, back in the Apollo era, Neil and Buzz and Michael Collins went to the moon, and Neil and Buzz went down to the surface, and they came back. And then it was almost seen as kind of a mission accomplished moment, right? Okay, we beat the Soviet Union. They didn't do it first. We did it first. We got there safe. And then there was, of course, Apollo 13 that ended up happening after Apollo 11, where we almost lost the lives of 3 astronauts onto the way to the moon. There was momentum in that program, but it kind of flagged pretty quickly. Then we ended up never going again until now, after 1972 with Apollo 17. So I hope that we will see more sustained support for this. I hope we will manage to somehow get the costs down a little bit. That would be really nice. I would like to see NASA able to do this important work of human exploration, human lunar exploration, and maybe ultimately beyond to Mars and elsewhere without shortchanging science. I think that these two things really go hand in hand. And while the current White House budget proposal for fiscal year 2027 does indeed include, I believe, more than $1 billion of new funding, of extra funding for the Artemis program to get to the moon, it also proposes canceling, I think, on the order of 54 science missions that are now in space. We just need to realize that by robbing Peter to pay Paul, we don't have to divide our house like that. We can actually do both. We can actually have both very nicely. And it doesn't even really shift the bottom line that much. Why do we have to make it this either or scenario? Let's just have both.
Lee Billings, always a pleasure to talk to you. And we'll look forward to what you're writing about in future issues of Scientific American. Thank you so much for joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn and Scott. It was my pleasure.